Gift Wrap. It was Christmas Eve. I was all by myself. Does that sound sad and pathetic enough to make you say, poor Sookie Stackhouse? You don't need to. I was feeling plenty sorry for myself, and the more I thought about my solitude at this time of the year, the more my eyes welled and my chin quivered. Most people hang with their family and friends at the holiday season. I actually do have a brother, but we aren't speaking. I'd recently discovered I have a living great-grandfather, though I didn't believe he would even realize it was Christmas. Not because he's senile, far from it, but because he's not a Christian. Those two are it for me, as far as close family goes. I actually do have friends, too, but they all seem to have their own plans this year. Amelia Broadway, the witch who lives on the top floor of my house, had driven down to New Orleans to spend the holiday with her father. My friend and employer, Sam Merlot, had gone home to Texas to see his mom, stepfather, and siblings. My childhood friends, Tara and J.B., would be spending Christmas Eve with J.B.'s family. Plus, it was their first Christmas as a married couple. Who could horn in on that? I had other friends, close enough that if I'd made puppy dog eyes when they were talking about their holiday plans, they would have included me on their guest list in a heartbeat. In a fit of perversity, I hadn't wanted to be pitied for being alone. I guess I wanted to manage that all by myself. Sam had gotten a substitute bartender, but Merlot's bar closes at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Christmas Eve and remains closed until 2 o'clock the day after Christmas, so I didn't even have work to break up a lovely, uninterrupted stretch of misery. My laundry was done. The house was clean. The week before, I put up my grandmother's Christmas decorations, which I'd inherited along with the house. Opening the boxes of ornaments made me miss my grandmother with a sharp ache. She'd been gone almost 2 years, and I still wished I could talk to her. Not only had Gran been a lot of fun, she'd been really shrewd, and she'd given good advice, if she decided you really needed some. She'd raised me from the age of 7, and she'd been the most important figure in my life. She'd been so pleased when I'd started dating the vampire Bill Compton. That was how desperate Gran had been for me to get a beau. Even Vampire Bill was welcome. When you're telepathic like I am, it's hard to date a regular guy. I'm sure you can see why. Humans think all kinds of things they don't want their nearest and dearest to know about, much less a woman they're taking out to dinner in a movie. In sharp contrast, vampires' brains are lovely, silent blanks to me, and werewolf brains are nearly as good as vampires, though I get a big waft of emotions and the odd snatch of thought from my occasionally furred acquaintances. Naturally, after I thought about Gran welcoming Bill, I began wondering what Bill was doing. Then I rolled my eyes at my own idiocy. It was mid-afternoon, daytime. Bill was sleeping somewhere in his house, which lay in the woods to the south of my place, across the cemetery. I'd broken up with Bill, but I was sure he'd be over like a shot if I called him, once darkness fell, of course. Damned if I would call him, or anyone else. But I caught myself staring longingly at the telephone every time I passed by. I needed to get out of the house or I'd be phoning someone, anyone. I needed a mission, a project, a task, a diversion. I remembered having awakened for about 30 seconds in the wee hours of the morning. Since I'd worked the late shift at Merlot's, I'd only just sunk into a deep sleep. I'd stayed awake only long enough to wonder what had jarred me out of that sleep. I'd heard something out in the woods, I thought. The sound hadn't been repeated, and I dropped back into slumber like a stone into water. Now I peered out the kitchen window at the woods. Not too surprisingly, there was nothing unusual about the view. "The woods are snowy, dark, and deep," I said, trying to recall the frost poem we'd all had to memorize in high school. Or was it lovely, dark, and deep? Of course, my woods weren't lovely or snowy. They never are in Louisiana at Christmas, even northern Louisiana. But it was cold. Here, that meant the temperature was about 38 degrees Fahrenheit. And the woods were definitely dark and deep, and damp. So I put on my lace-up work boots that I'd bought years before, when my brother Jason and I had gone hunting together, and I shrugged into my heaviest, I-don't-care-what-happens-to-it coat, really more of a puffy quilted jacket. It was pale pink, Since a heavy coat takes a long time to wear out down here, the coat was several years old, too. I'm 27, definitely past the pale pink stage. I bundled all my hair up under a knit cap, and I pulled on the gloves I'd found stuffed into one pocket. I hadn't worn this coat for a long, long time, and I was surprised to find a couple of dollars and some ticket stubs in the pockets, plus a receipt for a little Christmas gift I'd given Alcide Hervaux, a werewolf I'd dated briefly. Pockets are like little time capsules. Since I'd bought Alcide the Sudoku book, his father had died in a struggle for the job of packmaster, and after a series of violent events, Alcide himself ascended to the leadership. I wondered how pack affairs were going in Shreveport. I hadn't talked to any of the Wares in 2 months. In fact, I'd lost track of when the last full moon had been. Last night? Now I'd thought about Bill and Alcide. Unless I took action, I'd begin brooding over my most recent lost boyfriend, Quinn. It was time to get on the move. My family has lived in this humble house for over 150 years. My much-adapted home lies in a clearing in the middle of some woods off Hummingbird Road, outside of the small town of Bonton in Renard Parish. The trees are deeper and denser to the east, at the rear of the house, since they haven't been logged in a good 50 years. They're thinner on the south side, where the cemetery lies. The land is gently rolling, and far back on the property there's a little stream, but I hadn't walked all the way back to the stream in ages. My life had been very busy, what with hustling drinks at the bar, telepathing, is that a verb, for the vampires, unwillingly participating in vampire and were power struggles, and other magical and mundane stuff like that. It felt good to be out in the woods, though the air was raw and damp, and it felt good to be using my muscles. I made my way through the brush for at least 30 minutes, alert for any indication of what had caused the ruckus the night before. There are lots of animals indigenous to northern Louisiana, but most of them are quiet and shy, possums, raccoons, deer. Then there are the slightly less quiet but still shy mammals, like coyotes and foxes. We have a few more formidable creatures. In the bar, I hear hunters' stories all the time. A couple of the more enthusiastic sportsmen had glimpsed a black bear on a private hunting preserve about 2 miles from my house. And Terry Belfleur had sworn to me he'd seen a panther less than 2 years ago. Most of the avid hunters had spotted feral hogs, razorbacks. Of course, I wasn't expecting to encounter anything like that. I had popped my cell phone into my pocket just in case, though I wasn't sure I could get a signal out in the woods. By the time I'd worked my way through the thick woods to the stream, I was warm inside the puffy coat. I was ready to crouch down for a minute or two to examine the soft ground by the water. The stream, never big to begin with, was level with its banks after the recent rainfall. Though I'm not nature girl, I could tell the deer had been here, raccoons too, and maybe a dog. Or two. Or three. That's not good, I thought with a hint of unease. A pack of dogs always had the potential to become dangerous. I wasn't anywhere near savvy enough to tell how old the tracks were, but I would have expected them to look drier if they'd been made over a day ago. There was a sound from the bushes to my left. I froze, scared to raise my face and turn in toward the right direction. I slipped my cell phone out of my pocket, looked at the bars. "Outside of area," read the legend on the little screen. Crap, I thought. That hardly began to cover it. The sound was repeated. I decided it was a moan. Whether it had issued from man or beast, I didn't know. I bit my lip hard, and then I made myself stand up, very slowly and carefully. Nothing happened. No more sounds. I got a grip on myself and edged cautiously to my left. I pushed aside a big stand of laurel. There was a man lying on the ground in the cold, wet mud. He was naked as a jaybird, but patterned in dried blood. I approached him cautiously, because even naked, bleeding, muddy man could be mighty dangerous, maybe especially dangerous. "Ah," I said. As an opening statement, that left a lot to be desired. "Ah, do you need help?" Okay, that ranked right up there with, "How do you feel?" as a stupid opening statement. His eyes opened. Tawny eyes, wild and round like an owl's. "Get away," he said urgently. "They may be coming back." Then we'd better hurry, I said. I had no intention of leaving an injured man in the path of whatever had injured him in the first place. How bad are you hurt?
No, run, he said. It's not long until dark.
Painfully, he stretched out a hand to grip my ankle. He definitely wanted me to pay attention. It was really hard to listen to his words, since there was a lot of bareness that kept my eyes busy. I resolutely focused my gaze above his chest, which was covered, not too thickly, with dark brown hair, across a broad expanse. Not that I was looking. Come on, I said, kneeling beside the stranger. A mélange of prints indented the mud, indicating a lot of activity right around him. How long have you been here?
A few hours, he said,
gasping as he tried to prop himself up on one elbow.
In this cold? Jeez Louise, no wonder his skin was bluish.
We got to get you indoors, I said. Now. I looked from the blood on his left shoulder to the rest of him, trying to spot other injuries. That was a mistake. The rest of him, though visibly muddy, bloody, and cold, was really, really... What was wrong with me? Here I was, looking at a complete, naked and handsome stranger with lust, while he was scared and wounded. Here, I said, trying to sound resolute and determined and neutered. Put your good arm around my neck, and we'll get you to your knees. Then you can get up and we can start moving. There were bruises all over him, but not another injury that had broken the skin, I thought. He protested several more times, but the sky was getting darker as the night drew in, and I cut him off sharply. Get a move on, I advised him. We don't want to be out here any longer than we have to be. It's going to take the better part of an hour to get you to the house. The man fell silent. He finally nodded. With a lot of work, we got him to his feet. I winced when I saw how scratched and filthy they were. Here we go, I said encouragingly. He took a step, did a little wincing of his own. What's your name? I said, trying to distract him from the pain of walking.
Preston, he said. Preston Partlow.
Where are you from, Preston? We were moving a little faster now, which was good. The woods were getting darker and darker.
I'm from Baton Rouge, he said.
He sounded a little surprised. And how'd you come to be in my woods?
Well,
I realized what his problem was. Are you aware, Preston? I asked. I felt his body relax against my own. I'd known it already from his brain pattern, but I didn't want to scare him by telling him about my little disability. Preston had a smoother, thicker pattern than other wares I'd encountered, but each mind has its own texture.
Yes, he said. You know, then.
Yeah, I said. I know. I knew way more than I'd ever wanted to. Vampires had come out in the open with the advent of the Japanese-marketed synthetic blood that could sustain them, but other creatures of the night and shadows hadn't yet taken the same giant step. What pack? I asked, as we stumbled over a fallen branch and recovered. He was leaning on me heavily. I feared we'd actually tumble to the ground. We needed to pick up the pace. He did seem to be moving more easily now that his muscles had warmed up a little.
The deer killer pack, from south of Baton Rouge.
What are you doing up here in my woods? I asked again.
This land is yours? I'm sorry we trespassed,
he said. His breath caught as I helped him around a devil's walking stick. One of the thorns caught in my pink coat, and I pulled it out with difficulty. That's the least of my worries, I said. Who attacked you?
The sharp claw pack from Monroe.
I didn't know any Monroe wares.
Why were you here?
I asked, thinking sooner or later he'd have to answer me if I kept asking.
We were supposed to meet on neutral ground, he said, his face tense with pain. A werepanther from out in the country somewhere offered the land to us as a midway point, a neutral zone. Our packs have been feuding. He said this would be a good place to resolve our differences.
My brother had offered my land as a ware parley ground? The stranger and I struggled along in silence while I tried to think that through. My brother Jason was indeed a werepanther, though he'd become one by being bitten. His estranged wife was a born werepanther, a genetic panther. What was Jason thinking, sending such a dangerous gathering my way?
Not of my welfare, that's for sure.
Granted, we weren't on good terms, but it was painful to think he'd actually want to do me harm, any more than he'd already done me, that is. A hiss of pain brought my attention back to my companion. Trying to help him more efficiently, I put my arm around his waist, and he draped his arm across my shoulder. We were able to make better time that way, to my relief. 5 minutes later, I saw the light I'd left on above the back porch.
"Thank God," I said.
We began moving faster, and we reached the house just as dark fell.
For a second, my companion arched and tensed, but he didn't change. That was a relief.
Getting up the steps turned into an ordeal, but finally I got Preston into the house and seated at the kitchen table. I looked him over anxiously. This wasn't the first time I'd brought a bleeding and naked man into my kitchen, oddly enough. I'd found a vampire named Eric under similar circumstances. Was that not incredibly weird, even for my life? Of course, I didn't have time to mull that over, because this man needed some attention. I tried to look at the shoulder wound in the improved light of the kitchen, but he was so grimy it was hard to examine in detail.
"Do you think he could stand to take a shower?"
I asked, hoping I didn't sound like I thought he smelled or anything. Actually, he did smell a little unusual, but his scent wasn't unpleasant.
"I think I can stay upright that long," he said briefly.
"Okay, stay put for a second," I said.
I brought the old afghan from the back of the living room couch and arranged it around him carefully. Now it was easier to concentrate. I hurried to the hall bathroom to turn on the shower controls, added long after the claw-footed bathtub had been installed. I leaned over to turn on the water, waited until it was hot, and got out two fresh towels. Amelia had left shampoo and cream rinse in the rack hanging from the shower head, and there was plenty of soap. I put my hand under the water, nice and hot.
"Okay," I called. "I'm coming to get you."
My unexpected visitor was looking startled when I got back to the kitchen.
"For what?"
he asked, and I wondered if he'd hit his head in the woods.
"For the shower? Hear the water running?"
I said, trying to sound matter-of-fact.
"I can't see the extent of your wounds until I get you clean."
We were up and moving again, and I thought he was walking better, as if the warmth of the house and the smoothness of the floor helped his muscles relax. He just left the afghan on the chair. No problem with nudity, like most wares, I noticed.
"Okay, that was good, right?"
His thoughts were opaque to me, as were thoughts sometimes were, but I caught flashes of anxiety. Suddenly he leaned against me much more heavily, and I staggered into the wall.
"Sorry," he said, gasping. "Just had a twinge in my leg."
"No problem," I said. "It's probably your muscles stretching."
We made it into the small bathroom, which was very old-fashioned. My own bathroom off my bedroom was more modern, but this was less personal. But Preston didn't seem to note the black-and-white checkered tile. With unmistakable eagerness, he was eyeing the hot water spraying down into the tub.
"Do you need me to leave you alone for a second before I help you into the shower?"
I asked, indicating the toilet with a tip of my head. He looked at me blankly.
"Oh,"
he said, finally understanding.
"No, that's all right."
So we made it to the side of the tub, which was a high one. With a lot of awkward maneuvering, Preston swung a leg over the side and I shoved, and he was able to raise the second leg enough to climb completely in. After making sure he could stand by himself, I began to pull the shower curtain closed.
"Lady,"
he said, and I stopped. He was under the stream of hot water, his hair plastered to his head, water beating on his chest and running down to drip off his...
Okay, he'd gotten warmer everywhere.
"Yes."
I was trying not to sound like I was choking.
"What's your name?"
"Oh, excuse me."
I swallowed hard.
"My name is Sookie. Sookie Stackhouse."
I swallowed again.
"There's the soap. There's the shampoo. I'm going to leave the bathroom door open, okay? You just call me when you're through and I'll help you out of the tub."
"Thanks,"
he said.
"I'll yell if I need you."
I pulled the shower curtain, not without regret. After checking that the clean towels were where Preston could easily reach them, I returned to the kitchen. I wondered if he would like coffee or hot chocolate or tea, or maybe alcohol. I had some bourbon, and there were a couple of beers in the refrigerator. I'd ask him. Soup. He'd need some soup. I didn't have any homemade, but I had Campbell's chicken tortilla. I put the soup into a pan on the stove, got coffee ready to go, and boiled some water in case he opted for the chocolate or tea. I was practically vibrating with purpose. When Preston emerged from the bathroom, his bottom half was wrapped in a large blue bath towel of Amelia's. Believe me, it had never looked so good. Preston had draped a towel around his neck to catch the drips from his hair, and it covered his shoulder wound. He winced a little as he walked, and I knew his feet must be sore. I'd gotten some men's socks by mistake on my last trip to Walmart, so I got them from my drawer and handed them to Preston, who'd resumed his seat at the table. He looked at them very carefully, to my puzzlement.
"You need to put on some socks," I said, wondering if he paused because he thought he was wearing some other man's garments. "They're mine," I said reassuringly. "Your feet must be tender."
"Yes," said Preston,
and rather slowly he bent to put them on.
"You need help?"
I was pouring the soup in a bowl.
"No, thank you,"
he said, his face hidden by his thick, dark hair as he bent to the task.
"What smells so good?"
"I heated some soup for you," I said. "You want coffee or tea or..."
"Tea, please,"
he said. I never drank tea myself, but Amelia had some. I looked through her selection, hoping none of these blends would turn him into a frog or anything. Amelia's magic had had unexpected results in the past. Surely anything marked Lipton was okay. I dunked the tea bag into the scalding water and hoped for the best. Preston ate the soup carefully. Maybe I'd gotten it too hot. He spooned it into his mouth like he'd never had soup before. Maybe his mama had always served homemade. I felt a little embarrassed. I was staring at him because I sure didn't have anything better to look at. He looked up and met my eyes.
Whoa, things were moving too fast here.
"So, how'd you get hurt?" I asked.
"Was there a skirmish? How come your pack left you?" "There was a fight," he said. "Negotiations didn't work."
He looked a little doubtful and distressed.
"Somehow, in the dark, they left me."
"Do you think they're coming back to get you?"
He finished his soup, and I put his tea down by his hand.
"Either my own pack or the Monroe one,"
he said grimly. That didn't sound good.
"Okay, you better let me see your wounds now," I said.
The sooner I knew his fitness level, the sooner I could decide what to do. Preston removed the towel from around his neck, and I bent to look at the wound. It was almost healed.
"When were you hurt?"
I asked.
"Toward dawn."
His huge, tawny eyes met mine.
"I lay there for hours."
But suddenly I wondered if I'd been entirely intelligent, bringing a stranger into my home. I knew it wasn't wise to let Preston know I had doubts about his story. The wound had looked jagged and ugly when I'd found him in the woods. Yet now that he came into the house, it healed in a matter of minutes? What was up? Wares healed fast, but not instantly.
"What's wrong, Sookie?"
he asked. It was pretty hard to think about anything else when his long, wet hair was trailing across his chest and the blue towel was riding pretty low.
"Are you really aware?"
I blurted and backed up a couple of steps. His brainwaves dipped into the classic wear rhythm, the jagged, dark cadence I found familiar. Preston Pardlow looked absolutely horrified.
"What else would I be?"
he said, extending an arm. Obligingly, fur rippled down from his shoulder and his fingers clawed. It was the most effortless change I'd ever seen, and there was very little of the noise I associated with the transformation, which I'd witnessed several times.
"You must be some kind of super werewolf," I said.
"My family is gifted,"
he said proudly. He stood, and his towel slipped off.
"No kidding,"
I said in a strangled voice. I could feel my cheeks turning red. There was a howl outside. There's no eerier sound, especially on a dark, cold night. And when that eerie sound comes from the line where your yard meets the woods, well, that'll make the hairs on your arm stand up. I glanced at Preston's wolfy arm to see if the howl had had the same effect on him, and saw that his arm had reverted to the human shape.
"They've returned to find me,"
he said. "Your pack?" I said, hoping that his kin had returned to retrieve him.
"No."
His face was bleak.
"The sharp claws."
Call your people. Get them here.
They left me for a reason.
He looked humiliated.
I didn't want to talk about it, but you've been so kind.
I was not liking this more and more. And that reason would be?
I was payment for an offense.
Explain it in 20 words or less.
He stared down at the floor, and I realized he was counting in his head. This guy was one of a kind.
Pack leader's sister wanted me. I didn't want her. She said I'd insulted her. My torture was the price.
Why would your pack leader agree to any such thing?
Am I still supposed to number my words?
I shook my head. It sounded dead serious. Maybe he just had a really deep sense of humor.
I'm not my pack leader's favorite person, and he was willing to believe I was guilty. He himself wants the sister of the Sharp Claw Packmaster, and it would be a good match from the point of view of our packs. So, I was hung out to dry.
I could sure believe that the Packmaster's sister had lusted after him. The rest of the story was not outrageous, if you've had many dealings with the Wares. Sure, they're all human and reasonable on the outside, but when they're in their Ware mode, they're different.
So they're here to get you and keep on beating you up?
He nodded somberly. I didn't have the heart to tell him to rewind the towel. I took a deep breath, looked away, and decided I'd better go get the shotgun. Howls were echoing, one after another, through the night by the time I fetched the shotgun from the closet in the living room. The Sharp Claws had tracked Preston to my house, clearly. There was no way I could hide him and say that he'd gone. Or was there? If they didn't come in.
You need to get in the vampire hole, I said.
Preston turned from staring at the back door, his eyes widening as he took in the shotgun.
It's in the guest bedroom.
The vampire hole dated from when Bill Compton had been my boyfriend, and we thought it was prudent to have a light, tight place at my house in case he got caught by day. When the big Ware didn't move, I grabbed his arm and hustled him down the hall, showed him the trick bottom of the bedroom closet. Preston started to protest. All Wares would rather fight than flee. But I shoved him in, lowered the floor, and threw the shoes and junk back in there to make the closet look realistic. There was a loud knock at the front door. I checked the shotgun to make sure it was loaded and ready to fire, and then I went into the living room. My heart was pounding about 100 miles a minute. Werewolves tend to take blue-collar jobs in their human lives, though some of them parlay those jobs into business empires. I looked through my peephole to see that the werewolf at my front door must be a semi-pro wrestler. He was huge. His hair hung in tight, gelled waves to his shoulders, and he had a trimmed beard and mustache, too. He was wearing a leather vest and leather pants and motorcycle boots. He actually had leather strips tied around his upper arms and leather braces on his wrists. He looked like someone from a fetish magazine.
"What do you want?" I called through the door.
"Let me come in,"
he said in a surprisingly high voice.
Little pig, let me come in."
"Why would I do that?"
"Not by the hair of my chinny-chin-chin."
"Because we can break in if we have to. We got no quarrel with you. We know this is your land, and your brother told us you know all about us. But we're tracking a guy, and we gotta know if he's in there."
"There was a guy here. He came up to my back door,"
I called. "But he made a phone call, and someone came and picked him up."
"Not out here," the mountainous Ware said.
"No, the back door."
That was where Preston's scent would lead.
"Hmm."
By pressing my ear to the door, I could hear the Ware mutter,
"Check it out,"
to a large, dark form which loped away.
"I still gotta come in and check,"
my unwanted visitor said. "If he's in there, you might be in danger." He should have said that first, to convince me he was trying to save me.
"Okay, but only you," I said. "And you know I'm a friend of the Shreveport Pack, and if anything happens to me, you'll have to answer to them. Call Alcide Hervaux if you don't believe me."
"Ooh, I'm scared,"
said Man Mountain in an assumed falsetto. But as I swung open the front door and he got a look at the shotgun, I could see that he truly did look as if he were having second thoughts. Good. I stood aside, keeping the Benelli pointed in his direction to show I meant business. He strode through the house, his nose working all the time. His sense of smell wouldn't be nearly as accurate in his human form, and if he started to change, I intended to tell him I'd shoot if he did. Man Mountain went upstairs, and I could hear him opening closets and looking under beds. He even stepped into the attic. I heard the creak its old door makes when it swings open. Then he clomped downstairs in his big old boots. He was dissatisfied with his search, I could tell, because he was practically snorting. I kept the shotgun level. Suddenly, he threw back his head and roared. I flinched, and it was all I could do to hold my ground. My arms were exhausted. He was glaring at me from his great height.
"You're pulling something on us, woman. If I find out what it is, I'll be back."
"You've checked, and he's not here. Time to go. It's Christmas Eve, for goodness sake. Go home and wrap some presents."
With a final look around the living room, out he went.
I couldn't believe it. The bluff had worked.
I lowered the gun and set it carefully back in the closet. My arms were trembling from holding it at the ready. I shut and locked the door behind him. Preston was padding down the hall in the socks and nothing else, his face anxious.
"Stop!"
I said, before he could step into the living room. The curtains were open. I walked around, shutting all the curtains in the house, just to be on the safe side. I took the time to send out my special sort of search, and there were no live brains in the area around the house. I'd never been sure how far this ability could reach, but at least I knew the sharp claws were gone. When I turned around after drawing the last drape, Preston was behind me, and then he had his arms around me, and then he was kissing me. I swam to the surface to say, "I don't really..."
"Pretend you found me gift-wrapped under the tree," he whispered. "Pretend you have mistletoe."
It was pretty easy to pretend both those things, several times, over hours. When I woke up Christmas morning, I was as relaxed as a girl can be. It took me a while to figure out that Preston was gone, and while I felt a pang, I also felt just a bit of relief. I didn't know the guy, after all, and even after we'd been up close and personal, I had to wonder how a day alone with him would have gone. He'd left me a note in the kitchen.
"Sookie, you're incredible. You saved my life and gave me the best Christmas Eve I've ever had. I don't want to get you in any more trouble. I'll never forget how great you were in every way."
He'd signed it. I felt let down, but oddly enough, I also felt happy. It was Christmas Day. I went in and plugged in the lights on the tree and sat on the old couch with my grandmother's afghan wrapped around me, which still smelled faintly of my visitor. I had a big mug of coffee and some homemade banana nut bread to have for breakfast. I had presents to unwrap. And about noon, the phone began to ring. Sam called, and Amelia, and even Jason called just to say, "Merry Christmas, sis." He hung up before I could charge him with loaning my land out to two packs of wares. Considering the satisfying outcome, I decided to forgive and forget, at least that one transgression. I put my turkey breast in the oven and fixed a sweet potato casserole and opened a can of cranberry sauce and made some cornbread dressing and some broccoli and cheese. About 30 minutes before the somewhat simplified feast was ready, the doorbell rang. I was wearing a new pale blue pants and top outfit in velour, a gift from Amelia. I was feeling self-sufficient as hell. I was astonished how happy I was to see my great-grandfather at the door. His name's Niall Brigant, and he's a fairy prince. Okay, long story, but that's what he is. I'd only met him a few weeks before, and I couldn't say we really knew each other well, but he was family. He's about 6 feet tall, he almost always wears a black suit with a white shirt and a black tie, and he has pale golden hair as fine as corn silk. It's longer than my hair, and it seems to float around his head if there's the slightest breeze. Oh yeah, my great-grandfather is over 1,000 years old, or thereabouts. I guess it's hard to keep track after all those years. Niall smiled at me. All the tiny wrinkles that fissured his fine skin moved when he smiled, and somehow that just added to his charm. He had a load of wrapped boxes to add to my general level of amazement.
Please come in, Great-Grandfather, I said. I'm so happy to see you. Can you have Christmas dinner with me?
Yes, he said. That's why I've come. Though, he added, I was not invited.
Oh, I said, feeling ridiculously ill-mannered. I just never thought you'd be interested in coming. I mean, after all, you're not... I hesitated, not wanting to be tacky.
Not Christian, he said gently. No, dear one, but you love Christmas, and I thought I would share it with you.
Yay, I said. I'd actually wrapped a present for him, intending to give it to him when I next encountered him, for seeing Niall was not a regular event, so I was able to bask in complete happiness. He gave me an opal necklace, I gave him some new ties, that black one had to go, and a Shreveport Mudbugs pennant, local color. When the food was ready, we ate dinner, and he thought it was all very good. It was a great Christmas. The creature Sookie Stackhouse knew as Preston was standing in the woods. He could see Sookie and her great-grandfather moving around in the living room.
She really is lovely and sweet as nectar, he said to his companion, the hulking ware who'd searched Sookie's house. I only had to use a touch of magic to get the attraction started.
How'd Niall get you to do it? Asked the ware.
He really was a werewolf, unlike Preston, who was a fairy with a gift for transforming himself.
Oh, he helped me out of a jam once,
Preston said.
Let's just say it involved an elf and a warlock and leave it at that. Niall said he wanted to make this human's Christmas very happy, that she had no family and was deserving.
He watched rather wistfully as Sookie's figure crossed the window.
Niall set up the whole story tailored to her needs. She's not speaking to her brother, so he was the one who loaned out her woods. She loves to help people, so I was hurt. She loves to protect people, so I was hunted. She hadn't had sex in a long time, so I seduced her.
Preston sighed.
I'd love to do it all over again. It was wonderful, if you like humans. But Niall said no further contact, and his word is law.
Why do you think he did all this for her?
I've no idea. How'd he rope you and Kurt into this?
Oh, we work for one of his businesses as a courier. He knew we'd do a little community theater, that kind of thing.
The ware looked unconvincingly modest.
So I got the part of big threatening brute, and Kurt was other brute.
And a good job you did,
Preston the fairy said bracingly.
Well, back to my own neck of the woods. See you later, Ralph.
Bye now,
Ralph said, and Preston popped out of sight.
How the hell do they do that?
Ralph said, and stomped off through the woods to his waiting motorcycle and his buddy Kurt. He had a pocket full of cash and a story he was charged to keep secret. Inside the old house, Niall Brigant, fairy prince and loving great-grandfather, pricked his ears at the faint sound of Preston's and Ralph's departures. He knew it was audible to only his ears. He smiled down at his great-granddaughter. He didn't understand Christmas, but he understood that it was a time humans received and gave gifts and drew together as families. As he looked at Sookie's happy face, he knew he had given her a unique Yuletide memory.
Merry Christmas, Sookie,
he said, and kissed her on the cheek.
The End.